Welcome to Evening Under Lamplight, the show that invites you to attend. We're here, of course, on Cambridge 105, community radio in your city. And I'm Robert Louis Abrahamson, ready for what may come in this evening's show, Under Lamplight. I thought this week we'd take as our theme a concept that has always featured in my classes, the distinction between abstract ideas and concrete images. It's essential to understand these two terms if we are to be alert to how literature or music or painting actually works on us and what we are responding to. Let's start with a quick definition. A concrete image is one that appeals to our senses. It offers us details that we can see or hear or feel or touch or taste or smell. Here are some examples from my walk this afternoon. I saw the neighbor's young daughter coming back from her dancing class, quite easy with bare arms in the mild breeze, bouncing along as she walked with her mother, and then swaying her torso as though remembering some moves she'd just been practicing. I could smell that sweet, pungent odor of coal smoke from the house where the curtains are always drawn shut, and above the chimney there was a faint gray tinge from the smoke. I smelled the aftershave lotion on two teenage boys who walked past me, whiffs of that cheap, sharp aftershave coming to me in waves, even when they were quite a distance ahead. Did that scent stay with them all day at school? Later, passing under the chestnut trees, I could smell that rotting smell of damp autumn leaves underfoot, and I felt a few leaves falling on my head, not to mention the spider web catching me in the forehead yet again when I came up to the side door. And sounds? Well, there was a boy walking back from school up ahead who barked a dry hack of a cough at short, regular intervals, his grandmother telling him, "Don't cough so much, you'll damage your vocal cords." And the younger sister walking with the grandmother looked up and asked, "Why will he damage his vocal cords?" Well, you know the reply, don't you? "Because he will." But I heard all that, like Walt Whitman, a busybody walking through the streets, part of everything around me, aware of the concrete details, as we say. An abstraction, on the other hand, is, well, just the opposite. It's something we cannot perceive through our senses. It is an idea or a label giving some sort of intellectual meaning to the details. We could say that dancing girl showed the unselfconsciousness of youth, or the house with the coal smoke was an example of air pollution, or the damp falling leaves showed us it was autumn. These abstractions show us no pictures. Unselfconsciousness, pollution, autumn. But they help us make some sense of the world. They help us know where we are, and they can serve as a shorthand to describe our experience to others. Concrete details affect our emotions. Abstractions appeal to our minds. Ideally, we want both of them. But I'm afraid most of the time, most of us live in a world somewhere between the two, neither grounded in our bodily experience nor connected to precise ideas. Okay, here's an example we can play with. As you listen to John Lennon's song, God, think about whether it is abstract or concrete, or some combination of both. We'll come back on the other side and compare notes.
Yeah. just believe in me. Look on me.
That's reality.
Dream is over. What can I say?
God is a concept by which we measure our pain. You can see what Lennon is doing here, turning God into an abstract concept, an idea for measuring pain. I've heard that line each time I listen to the song, but I've never really thought about it until now. How do we measure our pain through God? Perhaps he means that if we have a lot of pain, we can measure or express that situation in terms of a relationship to God. Oh, I'm feeling so depressed. I must have done something really wrong and God is not helping me out. Or, I'm feeling really grand today. God has been good to me, a good measure of God in me today. I think that's what it means, but you see what I had to do. Lennon gave us an abstraction and I had to translate it into some concrete expression to make it come clear. And what I think it is showing me is that Lennon was stuck in that old Sunday school cliché of God rewarding the good people and giving pain to the bad people, a concept of God that does not agree with the experience of those people who have had genuine encounters with God, usually through their own struggles with pain. But in any case, God as a concept by which we measure our pain is not a very precise abstraction. Lennon was always at his best when creating slogans, which are expressions that don't have to mean a lot, but have to be catchy. All you need is love. Give peace a chance. These lines are sparky, but meaningless. What kind of love? Can you give me a concrete example of love? Yes, someone might say, love could be seen when someone hugs somebody else. Okay, good start, but that's not a very concrete image. What kind of hug? Is it a mother down upon one knee, opening her arms to her little child who's fallen and scraped her elbow and has just run over in tears? Or is it two adults greeting each other at an airport by putting their arms around each other? Or let's make that more detailed. Are their arms around each other's shoulders? Or perhaps the hands are down hugging the tuchus, the backside. Two different kinds of love there. All you need is love? Well, it's more complicated, John. Give peace a chance? Well, that reminds me of the Monty Python takeoff on Blue Peter and other shows that oversimplify things for children called How to Do It. Listen to how easy abstractions can be if we don't bother to ground them in the complications of real life.
Last week, we showed you how to become a gynecologist. And this week on How to Do It, we're going to show you how to play the flute, how to split an atom, how to construct a box girder bridge, how to irrigate the Sahara Desert and make vast new areas of land cultivatable. But first, here's Jackie to tell you all how to rid the world of all known diseases. Hello, Alan.
Hello, Jackie.
Well, first of all, become a doctor and discover a marvellous cure for something, and then when the medical profession really starts to take notice of you, you can jolly well tell them what to do and make sure they get everything right so there'll never be any diseases ever again.
Thanks, Jackie. Great idea. How to play the flute? Well, here we are. You blow there and you move your fingers up and down here.
Great, Alan. Well, next week we'll be showing you how black and white people can live together in peace and harmony. Yes. And Alan will be over in Moscow showing us how to reconcile the Russians and the Chinese. So, until next week, cheerio.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
You see, that's the problem with abstractions. They can be completely correct and yet have nothing to do with anything real. It's like Jonathan Swift's Modest Proposal, which proposes an infallible solution to poverty in 18th century Ireland. The projector who presents this idea has done his homework, and he offers this idea for no selfish purposes, only to help the nation. He very carefully sets out all the details of how the plan will work. He provides tables of figures to show how the Irish peasantry will have a much-needed increase in their income. The only problem is that this projector has not grounded his abstract idea in real life. His plan involves rearing Irish children to be killed at the age of 1 year to provide luxury food for rich English people, who will be happy to pay a modest price for this new kind of food. Read Swift's Modest Proposal and notice how the idea is correct and workable in every detail. A really well-thought-out concept, except that we don't live life in abstract concepts, but on the ground, through our senses and our heart. And our heart tells us we don't kill one-year-old babies, and we certainly don't eat them. Well, back to the song. John Lennon runs through a long catalogue of things he does not believe in, all abstract. Magic, I Ching, Bible, Tarot, Hitler, Jesus, Kennedy, Buddha, Mantra, Gita, Yoga, Kings, Elvis Zimmerman, that is Bob Dylan, Beatles. You might say that Hitler, Jesus, Kennedy, Elvis Zimmerman are concrete, but I'm not sure. They're specific, but we don't see them, do we? What aspect of Hitler, Jesus, Kennedy, etc. are we talking about? I think what Lenin is giving us here is a list of abstractions, labels, which people pass around to help them make sense of the world, but at the expense of losing touch with the actual reality. Here's Lenin, burned out and bitter after all those years as John the Beatle, never allowed to be himself, but made to fit other people's ideas of what he should be. No wonder he doesn't believe in any of these abstract labels. But the dream, or nightmare, is over. I just believe in me, Yoko and me. That's reality. All he's left with is the one intimate, concrete reality of his own feelings and his relationship with Yoko Ono. I was the dreamer, living in the unreal world of all those abstractions, and now I'm reborn. I was the walrus, but now I'm John. No more masks. So the song rejects abstract labels, but does it give us anything concrete in their place? Not through the words, but certainly through the music, that painful pounding beat, and then the sweet easiness of John's voice declaring he's reborn as John, not the walrus. If we can't really see what constitutes this new John, at least we can hear it through the tone of voice. And as John says, that's reality, whatever the abstraction reality means. Now, here's a little story about the danger, or rather the absurdity, of teaching abstractions without concrete details. One day, my son Neil came home from nursery school, about 6 years old, full of excitement. "Dad, we learned all about strangers in school today," he told me. "Dad, you must never take sweets from a stranger. See, here's the picture I colored in, and you must never accept a ride from a stranger. It's very important. But, Dad," and here a plaintive pause, "Dad, what's a stranger?" That's wonderful. He learned the lesson perfectly well, but because no one bothered to explain the abstraction or help the little kids see a concrete example, the lesson meant nothing. It's like saying you must never ever look a flumpy in the eye. We can learn that lesson by heart, but if we don't know what a flumpy is, there's no way the lesson can have any significance. What a waste of everyone's time. Oddly enough, Robert Louis Stevenson fits right in here. In his essay East Triplex, he is playing around with ways we understand life. Philosophy has worked at the problem about life. And, he says, after piles of words have been heaped one upon another into dry and cloudy volumes without end, philosophy has the honor of laying before us with modest pride her contribution towards the subject, that life is a permanent possibility of sensation. Truly a fine result. A man may very well love beef or hunting or a woman, but surely, surely not a permanent possibility of sensation. He may be afraid of a precipice or a dentist or a large enemy with a club or even an undertaker's man, but not certainly of abstract death. We may trick with the word life in its dozen senses until we are weary of tricking. We may argue in terms of all the philosophies on earth, but one fact remains true throughout, that we do not, properly speaking, love life at all, but living.
Speak, and the world is full of singing, and I am winging higher than the birds. Touch, and my heart begins to crumble, the heavens tumble, darling.
Oh, words, 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 I'm so sick of words. I get words only through, first from him, now from you. Is that all you blighters can do? Talk of stars burning above. If you're in love, show me. Tell me no dreams filled with desire. If you're on fire, show me. Here we are together in the middle of the night. Don't talk of spring, just hold me tight. Anyone who's ever been in love will tell you that this is no time for a chat. Haven't your lips longed for my touch? Don't say how much. Show me, show me. Don't talk of love lasting through time. Make me no undying vow. Show me now. Sing me no song, read me no rhyme. Don't waste my time. Show me. Please don't implore, beg or beseech. Don't make a speech, show me. But never do I ever want to hear another word. There isn't one I haven't heard. Here we are together in what ought to be a dream. Say one more word and I'll scream. Haven't your arms hungered for mine? Please don't explain, show me, show me. Wait until wrinkles and lines pop out all over my brow. Show me now.
There was Julie Andrews from the Broadway production of My Fair Lady, instructing Freddie Eynsford Hill to shut up with his words and just show her that he loves her. That's the point. Abstractions define. They tell us something, but concrete examples show us. They recreate the experience for us. Who wants a permanent possibility of sensation? We want a life instead, or as Stevenson puts it, we do not love life at all, but living. Concrete details, as I said, move us. They make us weep or make us laugh. Here's a little clip from an early stand-up routine from Woody Allen. Watch how the laughs arise from the concrete details delivered deadpan. He could say that at the racetrack he put his money on the lamest horse in the race, but instead, well, listen to his concrete detail. And he could have said that his seduction technique in his hotel room was inept, but we don't laugh at the concept of inept. We laugh at the accumulation of concrete details. see what I mean.
Now, in addition to my vodka ad, I also played Las Vegas for the first time. Listen, I'm not a gambler. You should know that about me, too. I went to the racetrack once in my life, and I bet on a horse called Battle Gun. And all the horses come out, and mine is the only horse in the race with training wheels. You know? You have to believe me when I tell you this. There's something seductive about me when I shoot crap. And I'm at the crap table, and I'm dicing. And a very provocative woman comes up to me, and she begins to size me up. And I take her upstairs to my hotel room, shut the door, remove my glasses, show her no mercy. And I unbutton my shirt, and she unbuttons her shirt. And I smile, and she smiles. I remove my shirt, and she removes her shirt, and I wink, and she winks, and I remove my pants, and she removes her pants, and I realize I'm looking into a mirror.
The abstract word for this kind of character is a schlemiel. But we laugh at the schlemiel only when we see him in action. Speaking of action, you're where the action is right now on Cambridge 105 Community Radio in your city, visiting us at Evening Under Lamplight with me, Robert Louis Abrahamson. We're attending to abstract ideas and concrete images. Now watch what these concrete details can do. I'm being a bit foolhardy now, daring to read an exciting poem full of verbal fireworks as well as of concrete details. The problem is that the poem is in Scots, and, well, I speak Scots with, I'm sure, something of a Philadelphian accent. There's no reason, though, why I shouldn't make the effort, especially since it's so much fun. But then there's the other problem that you might not understand the poem. Ah, well, as they say, just try your best. You'll get enough to catch the sparkle. The poem's called When the Oil Rins Out, that is, When the Oil Runs Out, by James Robertson, who has written to me, if you feel you can deliver When the Oil Rins Out with sufficient oomph and accent, then please go for it. Well, we'll see if I pull it off. This is a dystopian poem, projecting us into a future when there is no more North Sea oil, or perhaps no oil anywhere. It's that world we all dread, but all, at some level, know is almost inevitable. It will be horrible. Horrible? Well, that's just an abstract label. Don't tell me. Show me. So here's what may happen when the oil rins out. When the oil rins out, there'll be low roads, high roads, dinna ken why roads, traffic-free scenic routes, bus tours, I hae my doots, gazed tune retail parks, boats missing vital sparks, doom merchants busy building rainy day Noah's arks, ration wardens hunting doom tinned haggis hoarders, herds of wild shopping carts roaming through the borders, moosh cars, whoosh cars, gonna gie us a push cars, pedal cars, treadle cars, wha door metal cars, solar panelled polar camels gone hell for leather. Oh, we'll hae nae time to blether, we'll be in it all together as we hit the stormy weather when the oil rins out. When the oil rins out, there'll be bike chain, muscle strain, dish washing in the rain, atomic power, no thanks, mass grave, fish tanks, rubber band, satellite, closing dune at midnight, analogue or digital, wha's gonna gie a shite? High tar smokies, oot a coal-fired fish fans, Hame cooking czar's imposing oven-ready dish bands. We freeze in a squeeze, thaw out frozen peas. PCs on your knees, plugs out, if you please. Clyde built bed quilt for getting reeked under. Or you'd better be a runner, it'd be an office scunner, if you live to be a hunter when the oil rins out. When the Iorin zoot, there'll be wind power, wave power, Scotland, the brave power, camouflaged pylons, knit your ain islands, broken dune fridges, apocalyptic midges. Nay, repellent, did not think of that, yin did yas. Pensioners stocking up on 4th Fridays, loitering in libraries, Mondays to Fridays, cowed feet, nay heat, used up all the peat, snore, sleet, all wheat, just one to sit and greet, sair heed, hoft deed, hoden, dune, and wabbit. Oh, we'll all be doer and crabbit, it'll be our national habit, if you see a Connell, grab it when the aisle rins out. When the aisle rins out, there'll be triple glaze, sports clays, frostbite on your tees, big hairy mountain goats for turning into overcoats. Nay planes and nay trains, we nay destinations, streets full of police facing mass demonstrations, echo rebel agitators dune on their hunkers, B&Q and Tesco selling geothermal bunkers. Politicians in a fike, gie us a backy on your bike, lope the dike, tack a hike, here's to us, swa's like, nay cash, dinna fash, nay need for siller, ye can barter wi' the miller, be a bandit or a killer, or it's gonna be a thriller when the aisle rins out. When the aisle rins out, there'll be breed queues, greed queues, families in need queues, truncheon totin' gadgets wearing vigilante badges, models wi' hot water bottles sticked doon their summits, pausing at the end of modern culture as we ken it. Peely wally pushers dealing parage flavoured sucres, fur line breeks for royalty and wincyette for hookers. Tack, stock, winter shock, kill the last bubbly jock, windy's locked, wind the clock, tick-tock, tick-tock, time's up, scalt cup, nay, body's a winner, you can whistle for your dinner, be it holy Joe or sinner, I will all be pretty thinner when the aisle rins out. When the aisle rins out, there'll be cowed wars, hot wars, gie us all you've got wars, spiritual revivalists and khaki-clad survivalists, laird's men up the glen dug in for the duration, we double-barreled guns to cull the peasant population. Ferries full of refugees, windsurfing aff Tyree, Sabbath breaking Hebridean pirates on a spree, blind date, horn of fate, balls up on the slate, failed state, emigrate. Bit late there, mate. Ach, we'll big deal. Me, I'm past it. It was magic while it lasted. If you ken a spell, then cast it. What, you dinner? Damn and blast it. That's the aisle rin oot.
John is in a basement mixing up the medicine. I'm on a pavement thinking about the government. The man in a trench coat badge out laid off says he's got a bad cough, wants to get it paid off. Look out, kid, it's something you did. God knows when, but you're doing it again. You better duck down the alleyway looking for a new friend. The man in a coonskin cap in a pig pen wants $11 bills. You only got 10. Maggie comes fleet-foot, face full of black soot, talking at the heat, put plants in the bed, but the phone's tapped anyway. Maggie says the men say they must bust an early man, orders from the DA. Look out, kid, don't matter what you did, but walk on your tiptoes, don't tie no bows. Better stay away from those that carry around a fire hose. Keep a clean nose and wash the plain clothes. You don't need a weatherman to know which way the wind blows. Oh, get sick, get well, hang around the inkwell, hang bell, hard to tell if anything is gonna sell. Try hard, get bought, get back, ride rail, get jail, jump bail, join the army if you fail. Look out, kid, you're gonna get hit by losers, cheaters, six-time users, hanging around the theaters, girl by the whirlpools, looking for a new fool, don't follow leaders, or watch your parking meter. Oh, get born, keep warm, short pants, romance. Learn to dance, get dressed, get blessed. Try to be success. Please her, please him. Buy gifts, don't steal, don't live. 20 years of schooling and it put you on a day shift. Look out, kid, to keep it all hid. Better jump down a manhole, light yourself a candle. Don't wear sandals, try to forge the scandals. Don't
the handle.
Two catalogues of concrete details recreating the dystopian nightmare. Although, whereas James Robertson's When the Iorin Zoot speaks about some future disaster, Dylan's Subterranean Homesick Blues describes life today, or back in 1965, not that much difference. You can see how not just the words, but the sounds of the words recreate the experience. Yet it's a comic recreation, partly because they are both such playful pieces. Here are a few of the concrete details from James Robertson's poem, describing the world after the oil runs out. There will be Geisttun retail parks. Well, I've known a few ghost town retail parks over the past years. Doom merchants busy building rainy day Noah's arks. Yes, we hear from these modern day Noahs, the doom merchants, all the time. Dishwashing in the rain? A good idea, I suppose. Loitering in libraries Mondays to Fridays. That is, assuming the libraries can afford to stay heated, or rather, assuming that the libraries will continue to be funded at all. Cities full of police facing mass demonstrations. That is, cities full of police facing mass demonstrations. Oh, that's not likely to happen, is it? Maybe we should say cities full of police, tanks, and assault weapons. But of course, things weren't all that different in 1965, though perhaps, being New York, the polis came with a touch more paranoia. Maggie comes fleet-foot, face full of black soot, talking that the heat, that is, the police, put plants in the bed, but the phone's tapped anyway. Maggie says that many say they must bust in early May, orders from the DA. Look out, kid. Let's contrast this with the following poem, The Insomnia, by Ellen Bass, which I recently heard Jack Kornfield read on his podcast Heart Wisdom. She's not describing some catastrophic social disaster, but just an unpleasant private experience. There's some humor here, but in a more subdued key. Not much verbal play, in fact, so that we can get closer to the people she's describing. The overall feeling that comes from this catalogue of concrete details is one of quiet compassion for the pain and grief that, whether we admit it or not, unite all of us fellow human beings. Here's the poem. All over the world people can't sleep. In different time zones they are lying awake, bodies still, minds trudging along like child laborers. They worry about bills. They worry whether the shoes they just bought are really too small. One's husband's died. Her son left for college, and she doesn't know how to program the VCR. Another was beaten by her husband. One is planning a getaway. One holding stolen goods. One's on the plaid couch in the intensive care unit. His daughter, it turned out, actually does have a tumor, even though the doctor said they'd do the MRI just to rule it out. The woman on the other couch is snoring, which is strangely soothing, evidence that people do sleep. Some are lying on charisma sheets, some in hammocks, some in jail, some under bridges. One is at the North Pole studying the impact of pollution. A man in Massachusetts thinks about a lover he once had in Dar es Salaam and the jasmine blossom she strung along the shaft of a silver pin fastened in her hair at night. Coincidentally, the lover now in Rome remembers looking out the window over the sink when she was washing dishes and seeing him reading in the lawn chair, and she thought how, perhaps for the first time, she wasn't lonely. They're all up. Some are too cold, some too hot, some hungry, some in pain. Some are in hotels listening to people having sex in the next room. Some are crying. One, the cat woke up, and now she's worried about the rash she noticed in the evening and wonders if her daughter, who's afraid to swim, should be pushed. Some get up, others stay in bed. They eat Oreos, drink wine, or both. Many read. A few make Halloween costumes. Some check their email. They try sleep tapes, hypnosis, drugs. They listen to their clocks tick smartly as a woman in high heels. Those who can cling to their mates, an ear pressed to those neighboring lungs, like a stethoscope, hoping to catch a ride on the steady sleep breath of the other, to be carried like a seed on the body of the one who is able. Right now in Japan, dawn is coming, and everyone who's been up all night is relieved. They can stop trying. In Guatemala, the insomniacs are just getting started and have the whole night ahead of them. It's like a wave at the baseball stadium, hands around the world. So here's a prayer for the wakeful, the souls who can't rest. As you lie with your eyes open or closed, may something comfort you. A mockingbird, a breeze, the smell of crushed mint, Chopin's nocturnes, your child's birth, a kiss, or even me, awake at 3 a.m. in my chilly kitchen, with my coat over my nightgown, thinking of you. It wasn't easy to find something to follow up the theme and tone of The Insomnia by Ellen Bass, but I think the Teze chant Within Our Darkest Night may fit in here. It's a simple chant. Within our darkest night, you kindle the fire that never dies away. Not a very concrete image, a minimalist image, we might say, that gets repeated over and over, dulling our intellect and somehow seeping into our heart, leaving us free to apply this unspecific image to our own individual lives. Where has been your darkest night? What fire has been kindled in that darkness, and by whom? You may think of many concrete examples that may fit, and you can play with each, feeling its resonance. And that takes us to another feature of concrete details. They ask us to be flexible, to be comfortable with uncertainty. By the way, when an abstract idea escapes from rigidity and invites us to be flexible, we call it a paradox. All the best truths come to us as paradoxes. But back to the flexible images. Do we have the openness to accept that an image might bring us several meanings and all the meanings might be true, even if contradictory? I recall Robert Bly giving the readers of The Maiden King, a book he wrote with Marion Woodman, this warning. If you as a reader adore literalism, you may as well close the book now. You'll argue with our sallies so often that it will be bad for your health. Literalists, Bly is suggesting, hold too fast to only one sense of a concrete detail. They lay themselves open to anger and its consequent bad health. Now, how about something like William Blake's The Sick Rose, a poem that certainly offers us concrete imagery, but leaves it to us to make sense of it, or to make many different senses of it. O Rose, thou art sick. The invisible worm that flies in the night, in the howling storm, has found out thy bed of crimson joy, and his dark secret love does thy life destroy. And what further reverberations occur when this is set to music? That was the eerie Finn Corin's musical rendition of Blake's poem, The Sick Rose. And now it's time to move on to Walt Whitman, an expert with concrete imagery. We left our engagement with Song of Myself in the middle of a very long catalogue of concrete images. We saw lots of short images, and now Whitman expands himself a little with some slightly more developed images. We have scenes on the farm, in the backwoods, at sea, on the shore, on the western plains, and in a private house somewhere in one of the northern states. The big doors of the country barn stand open and ready. The dried grass of the harvest time loads the slow-drawn wagon. The clear light plays on the brown, gray, and green intertinged. The armfuls are packed to the sagging mow. I am there. I help. I came, stretched atop of the load. I felt its soft jolts, one leg reclined on the other. I jump from the crossbeams and seize the clover and Timothy and roll head over heels and tangle my hair full of wisps. Alone, far in the wilds and mountains I hunt, wandering amazed at my own lightness and glee. In the late afternoon, choosing a safe spot to pass the night, kindling a fire and broiling the fresh-killed game, soundly falling asleep on the gathered leaves, my dog and my gun by my side. The Yankee Clipper is under her three sky sails. She cuts the sparkle and scud. My eyes settle the land. I bend at her prow or shout joyously from the deck. The boatmen and clam diggers arose early and stopped for me. I tucked my trouser ends in my boots and went and had a good time. You should have been with us that day round the chowder kettle. I saw the marriage of the trapper in the open air in the far west. The bride was a red girl. Her father and his friends sat nearby, cross-legged and dumbly smoking. They had moccasins to their feet and large, thick blankets hanging from their shoulders. On a bank lounged the trapper. He was dressed mostly in skins. His luxuriant beard and curls protected his neck. One hand rested on his rifle. The other hand held firmly the wrist of the red girl. She had long eyelashes. Her head was bare. Her coarse, straight locks descended upon her voluptuous limbs and reached to her feet. The runaway slave came to my house and stopped outside. I heard his motions crackling the twigs in the woodpile. Through the swung half-door of the kitchen, I saw him limpsy and weak, and went where he sat on a log and led him in and assured him and brought water and filled a tub for his sweated body and bruised feet and gave him a room that entered from my own and gave him some coarse, clean clothes. And remember perfectly well his revolving eyes and his awkwardness, and remember putting plasters on the galls of his neck and ankles. He stayed with me a week before he was recuperated and passed north. I had him sit next me at table. My firelock leaned in the corner. What do we have here but a series of concrete details building up a few small scenes? How do we respond as we read these scenes? I think Whitman is asking us to share these human moments that he has conjured up in his imagination for us. He's beckoning us to come closer to him so he can point out the variety of American life. My friend, come over here and see what I have to show you. One problem for us, though, is that what may have been clear images to Whitman's 19th century readers are now entirely exotic to us. The slow-drawn wagon filled with hay moving through the big doors of the country barn. How many of us have actually seen a working farm, let alone one with a horse-drawn hay wagon? Can we tell the difference between Clover and Timothy? We have to take his word for it that the clear light plays on the brown, gray, and green intertinged. If we try hard, we can get some sense of the iridescence here. But we can recapture the delight of Whitman. Is this the boy Whitman? Suddenly appearing in the picture, sprawled on top of the load, one leg reclined on the other, and then when the wagon gets into the barn, he jumps from the crossbeams, surely some kind of clever boy's trick, rolling head over heels and tangling his hair full of wisps. In the other scenes, too, what strikes us most is Whitman's high spirits as he makes his appearance in each picture. Hunting alone in the far wilds, he wanders amazed at my own lightness and glee. On the Yankee Clipper ship, he plays with perspectives, settles the land, and shouts joyously from the deck. There's almost a giggle as he concludes his brief description of sharing clam chowder with the boatmen and clam diggers on the beach by giving us the line that always echoes in my mind, "You should have been with us that day round the chowder kettle." He's more solemn, however, at the wedding ceremony of the trapper dressed in skins and the red girl. Awed, too, at the sight of her coarse, straight locks that descended upon her voluptuous limbs and reached to her feet. The final scene is perhaps the most interesting and the most extended, as Whitman presents himself as giving shelter to a runaway slave, breaking the law, of course, but defiantly doing this. There's no more bouncy excitement here, but a quiet tenderness, his attention fixed firmly on helping this exhausted, wounded, frightened man, making him his brother, sitting next to him at the table, and always prepared to defend the man if there's trouble. He gives the man a room that entered for my own, so that if anyone comes to take the man, that person would have to face me first. And he sits eating with his rifle leaning nearby, just in case. So let's go through the lines once again, catching a little more of the details creating these scenes for us. No two visits to these scenes the same, as the details shift themselves in different ways in our imagination. The big doors of the country barn stand open and ready. The dried grass of the harvest time loads the slow-drawn wagon. The clear light plays on the brown, grey, and green intertinged. The armfuls are packed to the sagging mow. I am there. I help. I came, stretched atop of the load. I felt its soft jolts, one leg reclined on the other. I jump from the crossbeams and seize the clover and timothy and roll head over heels and tangle my hair full of wisps. Alone far in the wilds and mountains I hunt, wandering amazed at my own lightness and glee. In the late afternoon, choosing a safe spot to pass the night, kindling a fire and broiling the fresh-killed game, soundly falling asleep on the gathered leaves, my dog and gun by my side. The Yankee clipper is under her three skysails. She cuts the sparkle and scud. My eyes settle the land. I bend at her prow or shout joyously from the deck. The boatmen and clam diggers arose early and stopped for me. I tucked my trouser ends in my boots and went and had a good time. You should have been with us that day round the chowder kettle. I saw the marriage of the trapper in the open air in the far west. The bride was a red girl. Her father and his friends sat nearby, cross-legged and dumbly smoking. They had moccasins to their feet and large, thick blankets hanging from their shoulders. On a bank lounged the trapper. He was dressed mostly in skins. His luxuriant beard and curls protected his neck. One hand rested on his rifle. The other hand held firmly the wrist of the red girl. She had long eyelashes. Her head was bare. Her coarse, straight locks descended upon her voluptuous limbs and reached to her feet. The runaway slave came to my house and stopped outside. I heard his motions crackling the twigs of the woodpile. Through the swung half-door of the kitchen I saw him limpsy and weak, and went where he sat on a log, and led him in, and assured him, and brought water, and filled a tub for his sweated body and bruised feet, and gave him a room that entered from my own, and gave him some coarse, clean clothes, and remember perfectly well his revolving eyes and his awkwardness, and remember putting plasters on the galls of his neck and ankles. He stayed with me a week before he was recuperated and passed north. I had him sit next to me at table. My firelock leaned in the corner.
Thank you.